Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, June 8th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, bringing new technology to the Saratoga community by providing telehealth care for routine and urgent care. Telehealth medicine at Saratoga Hospital, saratogahospital.org to learn more. Joining us for Medical Monday is Dr. Jason Kirby of St. Peter's Health Partners, who is here to discuss addiction and recovery. Medical Monday is usually a very popular program. Always good to call early, 800-348-2551 if you have a question, 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Jason Kirby, your call's coming up on Vox Pop after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Medical Monday, and joining us today is Dr. Jason Kirby, who is the Medical Director of Addiction and Recovery Services at St. Peter's Health Partners. Dr. Kirby's professional interests include evidence-based treatments for opioid and alcohol addiction, population health policy, and advocacy for patients with substance abuse disorder. Dr. Kirby also served as medical director of Gateway Rehabilitation Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where he helped stand up an outpatient addiction treatment center. If you have a question for Dr. Kirby today, give us a call right now. Get in early. 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Jason Kirby, welcome to Medical Monday.
Well, hi, Ray. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. You know, we have seen over these past 3 months or more of this shutdown of most of the economy, and most people are being home. Well, you've seen anecdotal information. I've seen it on the wires and in the papers that addiction issues are up, alcohol and drugs, over this time when people are locked down and home. Couple quick questions for you. One, how do we know that for sure? And two, how do you deal with that with telehealth?
Well, thank you so much, Ray, again. Absolutely. With, you know, the pandemic has been catastrophic for people on a lot of different fronts. And from my perspective, from a substance use standpoint, one of the things that COVID has done was really take away most of the healthy outlets that people in recovery programs have been able to engage in. What we've seen across not only our region but across the country is that the level of disconnection, the amount of folks who become disengaged from their treatment program has been on the incline. And because of that, people are relapsing more. They're coming in to higher levels of care, including our detox unit, sometimes the hospital system, sometimes residential programs, in order to become reconnected. And unfortunately, that is a real thing. We're not only seeing it in this region, but seeing it across the country. We're hoping that as things start to open up a little bit, the amount of connection will improve. Telemedicine is a really interesting format. For years and years and years, primary care has used teleservices in order to engage patients that they wouldn't have been able to otherwise. A good example would probably be patients in rural areas who are unable to visit specialists because of proximity, or patients who are working professionals who don't have a lot of time to get to an office. Teleservices have been able to engage folks and get them into the healthcare system kind of on their terms, which has been wonderful. But addiction medicine, unfortunately, has been kind of at the back of the line when it comes to telemedicine services. A lot of that revolves around the federal regulations and state regulations regarding the medications that we use for opioid use disorder. Now, because of COVID, if there is a silver lining, it's the fact that telemedicine services for addiction medicine are pretty much on par with other types of services across the country. And we've seen an impressive new number of patients kind of entering our system, trying to get connected probably otherwise we wouldn't have seen if it wasn't for this this virus.
Well, now that's an interesting angle.
Telemedicine, I think, you know, probably would have come around for addiction medicine, but it would have taken a whole lot longer.
Now, this is an interesting point. In other words, you're seeing more people who are entering treatment just because they don't have to actually see you in person?
Right.
Wow. That's really something. What percentage of increase have you seen for those entering detox since mid-March?
Well, to be honest with you, we've seen an uptick of about 20% from what we've seen in our February census. Now, I will tell you that, you know, the census kind of waxes and wanes throughout the year. Some parts of the year are going to be a little bit busier than others. That's just kind of the traditional way to drug and alcohol treatment has kind of reacted. But what I can tell you is that we've never really had the census that we're currently having in early summer. And I think that that's probably directly due to that disengagement that I was talking about.
Dr. Jason Kirby is our guest today on Medical Monday. Dr. Kirby is the Medical Director of Addiction and Recovery Services at St. Peter's Health Partners. If you have a question, our number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Tell us about the everyday treatment that St. Peter's Health Partners provides in this regard. What is the first line of defense when you have a new patient?
Well, I think the most important thing is screening and stabilization. So anytime a new patient comes through our emergency system or gets identified up through our ambulatory program at St. Peter's Hospital, they are given a stabilization exam, and we kind of make a determination at that point which level of care they'll be most suited for. You know, detoxification services aren't necessarily useful for substances other than alcohol, benzodiazepines, and opiates. You know, substances like methamphetamines and cocaine don't really have a withdrawal that needs to be medically managed. So we're able to better determine that at that point after a detailed history and physical exam. After the screening and stabilization, if they meet criteria for our detoxification services, we typically admit them to our unit. We get them stable from a medical and psychiatric standpoint. And then the goal, I think, for everybody is what the next step is going to be. You know, what I tell my patients, this is just the first step in a marathon. So after medical and psychiatric stability, then we need to determine the level of care that they need next. And there's a few different options. There's a fair amount of our patients who transfer directly to residential units. There's a few around the region. We also have probably more functional and more stable patients that we also refer to our lower levels of care, including our intensive outpatient programming. We have 6 outpatient sites in the capital region that we can refer to. So it just, to be honest with you, it kind of just depends on the person, where they're coming from, and their level of need at the time.
Dr. Jason Kirby is our guest. It's Medical Monday. If you have a question about addiction issues, this is a great time to call. 800-348-2551 is our number. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Vox Pop Medical Monday, Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We're joined today by Dr. Jason Kirby, the Medical Director of Addiction and Recovery Services at St. Peter's Health Partners. And let's grab a quick call here at 800-348-2551. Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're up.
Is there a genetic predisposition to becoming an addict, or is it environmental or both?
Interesting question. Doctor.
Well, hi, Jim. Thanks for your question. I really do appreciate it. To answer your question, yes, there is a component for both environmental and genetics. We do know that patients without any genetic link do develop substance use disorders. In fact, when you look at the numbers, about 10% of people who use substances will develop a use disorder. But yes, having a family history, especially of first-degree relatives, so mothers, brothers, sisters, first-degree relatives, do put you at higher risk to develop a use disorder at some point in your life. Yes, it is multifactorial, though.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Now, the environmental aspects of that, you could sort of figure that out using common sense. Has science isolated the genetic component of this?
Yeah, that's actually the kind of the cutting edge of addiction medicine at this point. You know, the Mayo Clinic up in Minnesota is doing some amazing research looking at genetic markers, and we're starting to know more. But to be honest with you, Ray, we don't know enough right now where I could comment intelligently, but that is something that's a hotspot. Another type of genetic hotspot in addiction medicine is looking at genetic predisposition for medication to be more effective. So we do know that for some reason, some medicines that we use for use disorders are a little bit more effective in certain populations, and we think it has to do with a genetic component, but we don't know for sure.
Now,
so
you're speaking of Narcan?
The research being studied.
Are you speaking of Narcan or something else?
Not naltrexone, actually, is acamprosate, which is a medicine for alcohol use disorder.
All right, now that has been a thing, this medication that could potentially keep you off the sauce, as it were, off of alcohol. And I remember Keith Moon in the 70s was on the stuff, and then he drank and died. What is the cutting edge with that medicine, and has it changed markedly since the 70s?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, not a whole lot has come out with alcohol use disorder, looking at the different medications. As far as new medications, there have been a lot of studies looking, especially naltrexone, looking at decreasing somebody's quantity. What we know about naltrexone, looking at the studies, it doesn't necessarily prevent the first drink that well.
Yeah.
But what it does do is it decreases the amount, the quantity that somebody drinks, and it decreases the frequency. So if somebody drinks a fifth of liquor a day, sometimes they can get a benefit. Maybe they drink a pint of liquor every couple of days. Is it ideal? No. Unfortunately, we don't live in an ideal world, and it's really tough. Abstinence is a very tough model for a lot of folks to kind of come to grips with. That's why addiction treatment has never been and probably will never be solely medication-based. You know, there is a psychosocial component that needs addressed to really kind of give somebody the holistic shot of a recovery program.
And Dr. Jason Kirby is our guest. Dr. Kirby is the medical director of addiction and recovery services at St. Peter's Health Partners. What you just said leads me to a question I had for you when you mentioned physical addictions, opiates and alcohol and detox and that method. Is that an easier thing to tame in the short term or in the beginning than those psychological withdrawals, the meth, the cocaine, things like that?
Yes. Anytime that I have a resident or a fellow that I'm speaking with, a learner, I like to educate them. There is a difference between recovery and remission. So remission is basically the absence of the substance. Recovery is a holistic program. It's an improvement on how you view yourself and how you want to live your life, moving on. The goal of physical detox, you know, with opiate, you brought up opiates. The initial goal for me and my team is to take cravings and withdraw away for opiates, because that will decrease in essence, that'll decrease the relapse potential to use IV heroin and some of the other opiates. So You know, that's one of the reasons why buprenorphine, methadone, some of the other medicines that we use are so effective, because it takes away the cravings. It takes away that physical drive to use pretty quickly. You know, within usually 12 to 24 hours, buprenorphine will take somebody's craving to use opiates away. Now, having said that, that's remission. That's taking away the physical aspects of it. And as we know, substance use disorders, it has a very strong psychosocial component as well. So a person who chooses to live in recovery and to work a recovery program also has to deal with some of the other gasoline that's been making the fire, if you will, out of control for a really long time. And that's the harder part. That's the marathon part.
We will get to the phones in just 1 minute, but I had one more question going back to genetics, and I realize that it's still a work in progress. But a simple question, and maybe there's not a simple answer, is that genetic component that makes someone or leads someone to become, let's say, a heroin addict or an alcoholic, is that the same one that might make someone a gambling addict or a shopaholic or things like that?
So that's a great question, right? So substance use disorders are placed into a larger component of process addiction. So very similar to, OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. Substance use disorders have an obsessive part and they have a compulsive part. An obsessive part is basically kind of defined as, you know, the positive aspects. You know, you gamble because it makes you feel good. But eventually, everyone who uses substances to the point where they develop a use disorder, most of the time, if not all the time, they transition to a compulsive part where you're no longer chasing the positive effects. You're chasing to not have the negative effects, which is what we see with most of the substances of withdrawal, like alcohol, benzodiazepines, opiates. It all starts off as fun, and then all of a sudden, it's no longer fun. Now they just don't want to feel bad. And so the obsession turns into compulsion. And that's what we see with gambling as well. And there's other process addictions very similar to that. Gambling, sex, pornography, all have this kind of this component and this neuro anatomy. It all involves the same neuroanatomy. And yes, it is thought to all have the same genetic components.
Dr. Jason Kirby, our guest. Let's hit the phones once again. 800-348-2551 on this Medical Monday. 1-800-348-2551. Emma is in Saratoga Springs. Hello, Emma.
Hi. Hi, Dr. Kirby. Thank you. I just have a question. I've read a little bit about Suboxone potentially being used as a treatment for pain management as an alternative to opiates for either addicts or people with chronic pain issues who, you know, are just looking for an alternative to opiates. Do you know anything about that?
Well, thank you, Emma. Yes. So Suboxone is the brand name. The generic name is buprenorphine. Buprenorphine has actually been a medicine that's been used for chronic pain for years, actually, probably since the 80s. It comes actually in a transdermal patch called the Butrans patch. And it's FDA approved just for chronic pain. Now, Suboxone.
Would someone have to go to a pain specialist to access that? I don't know that doctors are commonly, you know, putting you on that kind of regimen.
Well, I think, you know, all pain specialists are a little bit different. The ones that I know from this area do not use buprenorphine for pain control quite as much as what I'm used to. However, it is a viable option. What I would say is, I don't. If you haven't spoken with your PCP, your primary care doctor, about a referral for an evaluation, it probably would be at least a good conversation to have. What I can tell you is Suboxone in and of itself is not FDA approved for pain management. It's only FDA approved for opiate use disorder. Having said that, there are some literature, there are some studies out there looking at pain as a comorbid condition along with opiate use disorder, and it has been shown to be a little helpful. However, it would be off-label, and so that you would have to talk with your doctor about that.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Emma, thank you very much. Dr. Jason Kirby is our guest, 800-348-2551. You mentioned methadone earlier, and it's my understanding, obviously not a doctor, that this is, I guess, a pseudo-opiate or something like that, and it's also very addictive. Is that something that is still being used regularly?
Well, yeah. So methadone is a viable option for opiate use disorder treatment as well. You know, it's methadone has been around since the 1970s. It's been studied. A lot of the specialty colleges, including the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, still recommend methadone as the treatment of choice.
Why?
For pregnant patients with opiate use disorder. It's a medicine that needs... regulated. It's a medicine that needs a certain person to be successful, but it absolutely has a place in addiction treatment. Not everybody is going to respond to buprenorphine. Not everybody is going to respond to naltrexone. Not everybody is going to respond to an abstinence-based type of program. And so, you know, the key thing that I tell myself and my team is that we just need to have more tools in the tool belt. If somebody's struggling with whatever their treatment plan is, then we need to alter the treatment plan. We need to figure out a solution in order to alter some of the variables to see if we can't get a better result. And methadone has been shown to number one, decrease mortality associated with overdose. Less people overdose when they're on methadone, and less people relapse when they're on methadone. Now, having said that, it's a different medicine than buprenorphine. Buprenorphine, the nice part about buprenorphine is it's considered a lot safer. It's easier to be prescribed in an office-based setting. You know, if you're a methadone program, you have to undergo special licensure by the federal government. I mean, there's a lot of red tape involved. And it's a fairly structured program. Not every patient can really follow through with that very structured program. And so, again, at the end of the day, do I think that methadone has its place? It sure does. But is it perfect for every single patient? Not necessarily. I think that one of my goals and my team's goals as addiction specialist is to make a decision and of who would benefit and who wouldn't, and then get them to the right places.
Dr. Jason Kirby, our guest today on Medical Monday, Addiction and Recovery Services at St. Peter's Health Partners, and our number is 800-348-2551. Carolyn Goshen, you're up.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling because I worked in the field and worked with coworkers who were in recovery themselves. And one of the concerns we had were that people who were referred to medication-assisted therapy, the providers seemed to ratchet up their doses very quickly, especially with methadone. They didn't do well on Suboxone, so they went to methadone. And instead of starting at 40 or 50, they were somewhere up in the hundreds for milligrams. And we were kind of shocked and wondered, you know, how are these people going to transition to long-term recovery?
Right. Well, thank you, Carol. Yeah, I think that, one of the biggest things is that, you know, there's a huge physician shortage in this country, but even more so, there's a huge shortage of addiction specialists. There's not a lot of folks like myself, we're few and far between. And I think that, you know, we bring to the table a skill set that not every physician probably can. We understand substance use disorder. We understand the psychosocial components that go into a treatment plan and how to and work with our clinical colleagues in order to maximize the relapse prevention potential. Now, having said that, we do know that buprenorphine does save lives. We know that methadone saves lives. And if you're in a rural area, in the middle of central New York or Pennsylvania or wherever, where you don't have access to an addiction specialist, then sometimes you do need the assistance of primary care physicians or other physicians who would be willing to prescribe these medicines because they do save lives. It's an approach that has been very well verified through the evidence. But yes, ideally, we would start now that addiction medicine is a recognized subspecialty to see more addiction providers, not only in the state of New York, but in the country at large. And I would love to see us in every single treatment facility across the country. I feel that we all do fairly good work. And, the board certification process is an evidence-based process. A lot of us, really want, most of us, if not all of us, want just the best things for all of our patients.
Carol, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Jason Kirby is our guest, Medical Director of Addiction and Recovery Services at St. Peter's Health Partners. I found it fascinating. You mentioned just now, and feel free not to answer this question if you don't know the answer. You'd mentioned there's a relative scarcity of addiction providers nationwide. Why is that? Does it not pay well? It seems like it would be a rather fulfilling angle for a doctor.
Well, that's a tough question, Ray. I mean, I think that the population in and of itself that we serve can be fairly difficult. There's a lot of trauma history. There's a lot of mental health comorbidities. There's a lot of socioeconomic issues and barriers to recovery. It can be fairly aggravating for a lot of folks. And people do relapse. Remember that addiction is a relapsing and remitting disease, and people are going to most likely undergo both stages of remission and relapse. And we need to be prepared for the relapse and deal with it when it does happen. And I think that can be very frustrating. So it takes a very particular type of person to want to do this day in and day out. It's certainly not a job. It's a thankless job, but I see it every day in the people that I serve, and I see it every day in their families. I love what I do. I can't imagine doing anything else. And we just need to get more programs out across the country to help attract people like myself who have, an invested want to help these folks get back to a functional life. And we need to put them in places where they'll be the most useful. I don't think that the money component is a real thing. I think it's more so just identifying who would be appropriate to do this the rest of their career, and then giving them the tools that they would need to be successful, which includes training programs in addiction medicine.
Is the addiction and recovery program at St. Peter's Health Partners a relative rarity across the nation? The extent of what you do?
At St. Peter's, I've worked in a lot of different systems, and it's very rare that I come across an organization that has the amount of resources that St. Peter's Health Partners does. I mean, I think that's one of the things that attracted me to coming to Albany. It's so rare to have a hospital-based, medically managed detox unit. Also two residential facilities. We have six outpatient sites. We also have two ambulatory programs as stabilization clinics. I'm working with some of my clinical colleagues. To open up consult services both at St. Peter's Hospital and Samaritan Hospital. So to answer your question, Ray, yes, it is fairly rare. A lot of hospital systems just don't have the money, the capital, or the resources to invest in such a massive amount of the levels of care options. And that's one of the things I think it's a wonderful thing for the Capital Region.
Dr. Jason Kirby is our guest. Tell you what, doctor, we'll take a quick break here. We have a lot of people on the line. We'll try to get to as many calls as we can right after this break. 800-348-2551 is the number. Welcome back to Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. We're joined today by Dr. Jason Kirby, who is the Medical Director of Addiction and Recovery Services at St. Peter's Health Partners. An educational hour. Thank you for spending it with us, Doctor.
Sure. Thank you, Ray.
All right, back to the phones we go. Mary Lou in Red Hook. Hello, Mary Lou.
Hello. I'm not 100% sure if this is relevant, but I mean, you were talking about genetics, and I was wondering, I have Parkinson's, and I've had it for 25 years, and it is something in which I have a great ability to work with medications. And I was just wondering, because you do that with rehab, is that something that would be along any line? Like if I do really well with the medication that I have, if I got something else, like I was an addictive personality, would the genetics equal? I mean, would it make just a better candidate for medication?
Well, thank you, Mary Lou. I appreciate your question. And I'm sorry to hear about your Parkinson's, but I hope everything's going okay for you. Well, you know, it's an interesting question. There hasn't been a whole lot of any studies, to my knowledge, looking at the cross-link between other cognitive conditions and substance use. We do know that people with trauma have about a 70% chance of developing a substance use disorder in their life, but people with intrinsic pathology like a Parkinson's or Alzheimer's or some of the other cognitive disabilities, we're not 100% sure of the cross-link or if there is a cross-link there. As far as your question, the medications, the efficacy for Parkinson's medications, to be honest with you, Mary Lou, I'm just not I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
Sure, that's fine. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Mary Lou, thanks a lot for the call. One email came in earlier, and I forgot to read it to Doctor. This one came in from Checo. Checo writes, my understanding of best practices regarding substance abuse treatment is to address all substances being abused at the same time, not in stages. That led to nicotine addiction being included and tobacco-free policies at rehab sites. Do you have information about any rehab services focused specifically for nicotine addicts, especially those with other health issues put in further jeopardy due to nicotine use, like COPD, et cetera, it's diabetes, et cetera? Outside of rehabs, I'm only aware of the worldwide 12-step fellowship Nicotine Anonymous, providing ongoing mutual support groups where nicotine addicts can access help, and that's from Checo.
Well, that's a wonderful question. I think, you know, addiction specialists have the unique opportunity to really address not only disease, but also quality of life as well. And so I can tell you at every level of care at St. Peter's Health Partners, my team addresses not only their drug of choice, but also nicotine. Are they taking care of themselves from a psychosocial standpoint? What are their barriers? Are they following up with PCPs? Do they have a psychiatrist? I mean, you know, there's a lot of different things that we can help folks with as barriers to recovery. And I will tell you that there is a huge correlation between people who use substances and tobacco use. And so most of the folks will screen positive for tobacco use, and we'll actually do some interventions both on the detox unit and also in our residential facilities. And there's medicines we can use. There's referrals to different organizations we can use. There's a lot of different ways to co-manage a tobacco use disorder, the same as a stimulant use disorder or an opiate use disorder. Now, I will tell you that a lot of folks are probably less willing to do everything at one time, but it is absolutely something that we address with every patient.
Dr. Jason Kirby is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551. Joyce is in Port Ewan. Joyce, you're up.
Well, thank you very much. I have a daughter who suffered from an eating disorder.
Okay. Oh, we lost her. Okay. Well, maybe you call back, Joyce, and we'll get you right to the front of the line. Meantime, we go to Mary Ellen in Athens. Mary Ellen.
Hi. Yes, I had a question about what specific programs are available for pregnant and postpartum women in the Capital District.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mary Ellen. So St. Peter's Health Partners does help facilitate, and we do accept pregnant women into our ambulatory program, into our residential units, and our outpatient units. We do, kind of tag team along with the obstetricians for any high-risk patients, which most of the women that we see are fairly high-risk. So there's kind of a team collective effort, but I can tell you that we do we do not turn pregnant women away. In fact, we invite them. We kind of open up opportunities because they're the highest risk of the highest risk. Other programs around the area that accept pregnant women, I believe some of the other residential programs. I don't know that for sure, but I can tell you that. All of St. Peter's Health Partners organization, for addiction medicine, we do accept pregnant patients.
Mary Ellen, thank you very much. Now over to Maggie in Pittsfield. Maggie, you're on.
Hi there. So, Dr. Kirby, my brother is undergoing a month-long opioid treatment on a Section 35 order, and he seems to be doing really well. So my question is, what are the best ways for us as family members to support him when he comes back in his recovery?
Oh, that's such a wonderful question, Maggie. Number one, congratulations. It's so wonderful to have somebody get the help that they need. And, you know, this really is a disease that affects the family probably more than any other disease that I can think of. And you guys need support and you need treatment yourself. And what I would say, if the treatment facility that he's currently at does not have any family programming, I would encourage you and any other loved ones and friends as well to reach out, to look at different, I don't know of any particular resources in your area for family programming, but I do know that some 12 steps are very helpful as well. Like Al-Anon, for example, is primarily geared towards family members of people in recovery. So, but family programming is a service that most of the treatment facilities around here do offer. But I would call and try to get a little bit more clarification on the specifics.
Maggie, thanks a lot. By the way, Maggie mentioned a Section 35 order. What is that?
So I believe I'm not familiar with every state has their own kind of particulars. It sounds to me like probably an involuntary commitment. Every state's a little bit different. Where I came from in Pennsylvania, it was called a 302 initiative. And all it's really kind of referring to is an involuntary commitment because you have concerns that the person is no longer taking care of themselves or are a danger to themselves.
Understood.
Again, there's no federal regulation kind of giving this a systematic approach. Every state kind of has their own laws regarding that, and some are easier to do, some are harder to do. I'm not familiar with that one. I assume if she was calling out of Pittsfield, maybe it's Massachusetts.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with Massachusetts state laws, but it sounds like an involuntary commitment.
Would you be in favor of a federal approach to this?
Well, here's what I would be in favor of, Ray. I would be in favor of making it as easy as possible to get people the resources they need to be successful. I will tell you that in order to be successful in a recovery program, a person has to have a certain degree of willingness to participate. I mean, it's not going to be enough to just sentence them for 5 or 10 years of drug and alcohol rehab for them to get better. I wish it were the case, but the studies that we've seen on the criminal justice system just show that that's not so. There has to be some element of internal motivation in there. And the goal of what I try to do and my team tries to do, if somebody comes to us with a completely external motivation, say they're being referred by drug court or probation, right, or their wife or husband's threatening to leave them or whatever the case may be, we can use that as a beginning point to try to affect some internal change, trying to show them a better path, and trying to hopefully engage them into kind of moving through the stages of change. So at the end of the day, whenever they complete the program, they'll want to be sober for them. They'll want to be in a recovery program for them.
Do we have any idea how successful mandatory, in lieu of incarceration, let's say, a mandatory program like a Section 35 order, do we have any idea just how successful they are as compared to voluntary?
Well, I think that it's a great way, again, to get folks through the door. You know, one of my biggest gripes, I think, getting into addiction medicine was how hard it is for certain people, especially folks who are a little bit further down on the socioeconomic ladder, to get the resources they need to be successful. You know, if you have money in this country or great insurance, you can almost get the best addiction care that money could buy. But if you don't have those resources, it can be a little bit difficult. And I think that one of the things we could do better as a society is just make sure that if somebody has an ailment, whether it be a physical ailment or a mental ailment, that the resources are going to be available for them to utilize, whenever they can. And whenever folks are being referred by an emergency room somewhere, or if folks are being referred by their primary care doctor, that there's no red tape, there's no barriers. People who want treatment should get treatment, and we should figure out a way. And that's what I think is the biggest thing that we need to do, for sure.
Dr. Jason Kirby, our guest, and Jessica is in Great Barrington. Jessica, you're on.
Thanks. I was wondering if I do have time that I could call you up and ask the question on the phone another time, or do I need to ask it right now?
Well, the show's almost over. You could try it if you want, or not, I suppose.
Well, my question is, I know someone close to me, it's a male, and they first were on opioids at age 20, and they've been clean for a year now, or 2 years now, and they're 41 now. They relapsed when they were 27, so they had a good 7-year clean period on methadone, and then they relapsed again another 9 years later when they were 38, and then again when they were 39. My question is, I don't know what treatment they're getting because their family's not telling me exactly what they're getting, but I guess they're getting some kind of medical treatment now. Should they be in therapy also? Because I know you said there's a difference between remission and recovery.
Okay, that's a good question. Doctor.
Well, I think that I don't know the particulars in this case, and thank you, Jessica, for calling. What I can tell you is most of the time, a person with a substance use disorder has a multifactorial approach to a treatment plan. I mean, I can tell you that most of the patients that I see, medication alone isn't a part of the treatment plan. We also look at other barriers to recovery, including psychiatric illness, including other medical comorbidities, and psychosocial health. I say it all the time to my team. You know, addiction is a fire. Imagine you're in the woods and you want to build a fire to stay warm. You get a bunch of kindling and you build this really, really small fire. And at first, it's so easy to put out that fire, it wouldn't take anything to put out that fire. A strong wind could do it. But what happens if you put gasoline on that fire? The fire is going to get bigger. And we see that. And everyone's gasoline is a little bit different. For a lot of folks, the gasoline is trauma. And for some folks, maybe it's chronic pain. Everyone's gasoline is going to be a little bit different. And one of the best parts about therapy is the fact that you can identify what your particular gasoline is and maybe take that away and make that fire a little bit more controllable. Now, I will tell you that you'll never be able to put that fire out. addiction and substance use disorder, once somebody has a use disorder, they're going to have it the rest of their life, but it can be very, very manageable.
Why is that?
You have to take away the gasoline.
That is my question. Why? Why is it a forever thing?
Well, it changes to an extent the brain chemistry. What we do know about addiction is that it is a progressive disease. And you may be in remission for a time. You may be in recovery for 15, 20, 30 years. But if you go back to using, it will always be progressive. It will always get worse. And that's what we've seen. That's what we know about addiction.
Dr. Jason Kirby is here, and we only have a minute left, so let's go to Suzanne in Warwick. Suzanne, very quickly, okay?
How long is it safe to be on Suboxone? My son's on Suboxone. He also suffers from back pain. He has had back surgery, which is what got him addicted to opioids. And because I understand it's very painful to get off of Suboxone, so maybe it's helping him.
What I would say is people can be on buprenorphine, methadone, naltrexone, all the medications for as long as it takes to be stable. There's no guaranteed length. You know how, if you're on certain heart medications, they say no longer than a year. Well, that's not how it is for substance use disorder treatment. You know, what I could tell you, what I do in my practice is, after a length of time and after somebody has shown some markers for recovery, we have a conversation. Hey, what do you envision your life is going to be like in 5 years? Do you think this medication is going to be a part of it or not? And, probably more than any other aspect of medicine I've ever worked in, this is a team approach between myself and the patient and trying to figure out which is the best way to go.
All right.
I will tell you that rapid detoxes with these medicines do not work. People relapse and people overdose more when they do rapid detoxes.
Okay.
So if people do elect to stop agonist therapies and other type of medication-assisted therapies, it needs to be over a longer period of time, and they need to be monitored for any signs and symptoms of relapse, because relapse, unfortunately, can be deadly.
Dr. Jason Kirby, we are out of time, sir, but thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it. Learned a lot today. Support comes from Dr. Jean Shen, specializing in endoscopic spine surgery and disc regeneration, treating disc herniations, spinal stenosis, and myelopathy. envisionspinesurgery.com for details. Once again, thanks to Dr. Jason Kirby of St. Peter's Health Partners for being with us today. Fine job, sir. Thank you for being here. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Zach, our engineer. Kayleen White took the calls. Our producer is Jackie Orchard. Tomorrow, Dr. Oscar Williams of UAlbany's Africana Studies Department joins us to discuss the history of civil rights as they relate to recent events. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.